Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline. I hope you're having a safe and fun Labor Day weekend. This hour, we're sharing some of our favorite conversations from this summer. Later, we'll hear from a researcher whose work is reshaping the way we think about burnout. But first, American politics has had no shortage of its conspiracy theories. Think about questions about who shot President Kennedy or Area 51. But in the past few years, it's easy to name many more. Pizzagate, birthers, the death of Vince Foster. At the same time, our politics have become so much more polarized. So, University of Chicago political scientist Eric Oliver has asked, could the force driving conspiracy theories also be the same one that's dividing our country? Eric spoke with Nyla Boodoo back in June.
So when we think about conspiracies in this world of political fake news, our own President Trump fueled fire that former President Obama wasn't a citizen, that's a conspiracy that lingers today. How much lingering are we talking about? Do we know how many people still believe that, even though that is not true?
Sure. So I've been asking in public opinion surveys over the past 10 years a variety of questions about conspiracy theories. So I've been trying to take six or seven common conspiracy theories, things like the truther conspiracy theory that 9/11 was an inside job, for example, or the birther conspiracy that you just mentioned about Barack Obama. And we typically find when we do surveys that about half of Americans will agree with at least one conspiracy theory. And so when we first started doing this, we were pretty surprised about this. The fact that, you know, at least one in two of us will agree with one conspiracy theory that's generally kind of out there.
So this wow, that's a lot, Eric.
It is. And it really surprised us. And if you look at some of the specific numbers, you know, even today, while, you know, at its peak, I should say, for example, the birther conspiracy theory, about 25% of the people, the American public, was agreeing with the birther conspiracy theory. That number's gone down somewhat since Barack Obama has left office. We still get around anywhere from like 15 to 18% of people believing that 9/11 was an inside job.
Inside job meaning the American government did it?
That the American government secretly planned the attacks of 9/11 in order to facilitate going to war in the Middle East. That's the conspiracy theory.
Oh, okay. And then what are the other big conspiracy theories that are out there?
Well, probably the most popular one is as a kind of a less partisan conspiracy theory, and this is the idea that the Food and Drug Administration is deliberately withholding natural cures from cancer from making it onto the market because of secret pressure from the pharmaceutical industry. And we usually get about 40% of Americans agreeing with that.
Wow. Okay. So you've been studying why so many people believe conspiracy theories and what that says about how we understand the world. What have you learned? Are there sort of basic personality traits or beliefs that correlate with belief in conspiracies?
Sure. So when we started doing this research, then once we were struck by, wow, the large numbers of people believing in this, we were trying to figure out, well, who exactly was doing this and why? And some of the things that we might expect, like, for example, people who are less trusting of others tend to, you know, we ask people, do you think people can generally be trusted in these types of questions? Those types of people are more likely to believe in conspiracy theories, not surprising there. Some of the more surprising things, though, came from people who have a lot of supernatural or paranormal beliefs tend to be very much more likely to believe in conspiracy theories. So, for example, you know, if you believe in ESP or ghosts, or you believe that, you know, God has a plan for everyone, those people who embrace those types of beliefs tend to also are more likely to believe in conspiracy theories.
And then do you actually break this down like into whether people are intuitionists or rationalists? That's kind of how you understand it?
Well, this is what then prompted so we just finished a book about this called Enchanted America. And the idea of the book is that American politics are not simply organized by things like partisanship or ideology or even race, but by what we might call worldview. And at one end of this worldview are people we call rationalists. And these are people who rely on deduction and facts and logic and reason to understand what's going on in the world. And on the other end of the spectrum are people we call intuitionists. And intuitionists tend to go with their gut feelings. They're heavily swayed by symbols and metaphors. And they really go much more with their heart than their head when they're trying to understand the world. And what we basically find is that people who believe in conspiracy theories, just like people who have a lot of supernatural beliefs or paranormal beliefs, tend to be much more stronger on the intuitionist side of the spectrum. They tend to really be people who go more with their guts, and they listen to what their gut is telling them. And, you know, if they're feeling apprehensive, their gut is telling them that the world's a scary place and that there's probably something going on that they need to be worried about.
And does that correlate with political or ideological belief, whether you are in either of these, whether you're an intuitionist or a rationalist?
Yes. So our theory was that we've only been collecting data on this for the past few years. But we think that historically, these two things have not been necessarily aligned with politics. And, you know, you'd find intuitionists on the political left just as you would find them on the political right. But what we found when we were doing our surveys and when we were measuring sort of this intuitionist proclivity, that we were beginning to see a much stronger political alignment. We see far more intuitionists now on the right who identify themselves as conservative, and liberals are much more likely to be, people who identify as liberalists are much more likely to score high as rationalists. And if you look at a lot of political discourse right now, it's not that surprising. So, you know, you have liberals who go up and they have yard signs that say, "We believe in science." Meanwhile, you have a lot of conservatives who are denying things like climate change. A very large percentage of them are fundamentalist Christians who believe that we're living in end times as foretold by biblical prophecy. What we're beginning to see is something that's changing in American politics. And I think the biggest example of this, if you look at a lot of rationalist conservatives that are out there, so like someone like a Bret Stephens, who's a columnist for the New York Times, you know, he is somebody who feels very right now on the margins of conservatism because his type of perspective is really being supplanted by this much more intuitionist worldview, which is, you know, based on conspiracy theories and kind of gut feelings and, you know, this kind of more visceral reaction to politics.
So I wonder, Eric, how your research gives you insight into how conservatives and liberals prefer to communicate or be communicated to.
Well, this is one of the things that I think explains why we have such a strong political divide in this country. If liberals and conservatives, say, for example, were reasonable and rationalistic, they might, you know, disagree about outcomes, but at least the terms of the debate by which they can, you know, discuss politics would be recognizable. But when you have some group that is strongly intuitionist and another group that's strongly rationalist, it's very, very difficult to communicate. I think a lot of people have had the experience, for example, of, you know, being in a family gathering where you have a family member who is a strong conspiracy theorist or has some sort of strong magical belief, and you're trying to dissuade this person. You could see how difficult it is to talk them out of it, that these beliefs that they hold are very strongly rooted in their own emotional processes. And so one of the things that we suggest in our research is that this is why America seems so divided. And we had, you know, we were interviewing people for the book, and we had one person who we were interviewing, and we were going back and forth and trying to understand the logic behind a lot of her inconsistent kind of political ideas. And she turned to us and she said, "Well, you know, the difference between you and me is that you believe in reason and I believe in the Bible." And that was a very prescient statement on her part. Like the kinds of criteria that we, for example, as academics employ in thinking about politics, were just not that relevant for her. And she had a different guidepost for how she kind of understood what was happening in the world.
I'm speaking with Eric Oliver. His book that he's talking about is called Enchanted America, How Intuition and Reason Divide Our Politics. He teaches political science at the University of Chicago. Eric, and so when we think about that, you said that historically these things haven't been aligned with politics. What do you think has changed? Because I imagine you would think this changed before President Trump took office.
Yes, this has been going on for a while. And if you go back and say, look in at the late 1950s, and you would poll most Americans, almost everyone in the United States believed in God. And there was really, really broad enthusiasm for science and the progress of science. And there was this kind of consensus around those types of issues. And as a country, we've really begun to polarize on this dimension. We probably have around 20-25% of Americans who no longer believe in God. And you have a significant chunk of Americans who believe in sort of very strong fundamentalist ideas about God. And conversely, we're also seeing this big division on science now, where some people are very trusting of science and some people mistrusting of science. And I think one of the reasons why this aligned was the mobilization of conservative Christians into politics, and this started happening in the 1970s, partly in response to things like the Supreme Court getting rid of prayer in public school, affirming abortion rights in Roe v. Wade. I think there was also a great apprehension among Southern conservatives with the civil rights movement that parochial schools in the South would become integrated. And there was a great sort of racial apprehension about this. And so this served to really kind of politicize Southern conservatives. And they moved into the Republican Party. And this really started happening in the 1980s. And this fusion of Southern conservatives with a lot of moral traditionalism into kind of the traditional economic liberalism of conservatism in the United States really kind of was what the Reagan coalition was built around. And you can see signs of this. So, you know, Pat Buchanan, for example, running in the 1990s, he was somebody who was really appealing to kind of an intuitionist framework. Sarah Palin was another figure who really sort of animated this aspect of the party. And I think when you see with Donald Trump is kind of he now has empowered this element of the conservative movement. That's a very strongly intuitionist movement. I mean, if you look at Donald Trump's rhetoric, it's an intuitionist rhetoric. He himself says, you know, I don't really think about problems. I just go with my gut, you know, and it's not, you know, coincidental that he then also believes in traffics and conspiracy theories. And there's a whole constellation of other kinds of attitudes that kind of go with this sort of intuitionist perspective.
But where do most people lay on the spectrum? Are they? It's because I feel like what you've described are maybe people who have pretty strong beliefs who tend to maybe be on the edges. Are most people like that?
Well, another way of thinking about this is like ideology. You know, we often talk in terms of politics of liberals and conservatives, but most Americans are actually pretty moderate in their political views. And the same thing we could say with intuitionism and rationalism. And according to our measures, most people are somewhere in between. And if you think about it, you know, we all tend to rely on both our intuitions at times and our reason at times. But where people are in terms of how much they rely on one another can actually say a lot about their politics. Some of the factors that determine where people are on this scale are, were they raised, for example, in a religiously conservative household, the amount of education that they have, the amount of stress that they feel. People who tend to be stressed more tend to be a lot more intuitionist in their orientation. There's some personality differences, like some people like to think about problems and solve problems and really like puzzles, and those people tend to be a lot more rationalistic. Some people just don't like to think very hard about issues, and they tend to be more intuitionist.
Eric, when we think about this, I wondered if I could just end by asking you about if the goal is to reduce some of these divisions, as we've talked about polarization and how far apart people are, but we've also, through your research, learned a little bit about communication. Do you feel like, what have you learned anything helpful about how we can maybe reduce some of the divisions that we have?
So I've been trying to think a lot about this. And the story that keeps coming to mind is when my son was 5 years old and he was really scared about a monster in the closet. And, you know, he was screaming one night and I came in and I, you know, turned on the lights in this room and I opened up the closet and I was trying to reason with him and telling him there's no monster in the closet. And finally he turned and looked at me and he said, well, you know, if there's no monster in the closet, then why am I afraid? And I think this actually speaks to this intuitionist reason debate. When someone who's taking a reasoned position is trying to speak to someone who has an intuitionist perspective, reasoning with them is not going to work very well. But listening to them and acknowledging the source of their emotions and their apprehensions and their anxieties can be a way, I think, of fostering better dialogue and better understanding. And I think it's oftentimes difficult for people who have a rationalist perspective to find out a way to communicate somebody who's an intuitionist because, you know, intuitions aren't necessarily clear to us. They seem to come from, like, the murky depths of our gut. And I think the first step is by acknowledging that, you know, people who typically are relying on their intuitions are probably doing so because they're feeling pretty apprehensive and they're feeling pretty anxious about something. And I think acknowledging the sources of that apprehension or anxiety is probably the first step to then kind of facilitating kind of a greater communication and trying to talk across this gulf.
And are we assuming that the rationalists are the only ones trying to communicate? I wonder how we can think about how intuitionists can better listen to rationalists.
Yes, true. And I think that's, you know, it's not just sort of on one side. And I think the other part of this is to say, you know, we live in a liberal democracy, and a liberal democracy is a product of the Enlightenment. It's a reason-based system, and you know, reason has created, you know, our science has created incredible benefits for our society in terms of health, our economy, our well-being. And, you know, continuing to remind people that, you know, science and reason are serving us very, very well. And when we deviate from that is typically when we see disasters. So I think some sort of reminding of that is also important as well.
That's Eric Oliver speaking with Nyla Boodoo earlier this summer. Coming up after the break, why new research could change what burnout really means. Stay tuned. That's coming up in just a minute. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Moldeen. Many of us have experienced a feeling of being burnt out. A long week at work or at home can leave us feeling exhausted, both physically and emotionally. But when does everyday stress turn into something more serious? Now the World Health Organization has changed and clarified the definition of burnout and separated it from other stress syndromes. Researchers hope the change will bring more awareness and more options for treatment. Samantha Coleman is a professor in industrial and organizational psychology at Adler University in Chicago. She spoke with Nyla Boodoo earlier this summer.
Professor Coleman, when we say burnout, what do we mean by that? Because I think there are a lot of popular definitions of this, and this is something that people say all the time, oh, I'm burnt out. But what should we be thinking about this from a clinical standpoint?
From a clinical standpoint, I think that we should really be looking at burnout as, you know, really a work-related struggle that we are experiencing, mostly between ourselves and our work. So almost like this relationship that we have. And when it becomes too overwhelming and too much for us to be able to handle, we come to a place where we are both physically and emotionally exhausted. And because of that, we begin to experience any number of symptoms, such as fatigue or insomnia, or even coming down to our workplace performance. So all of these things kind of, you know, come together in a nice little medley, if you will, that results in us feeling depleted.
And so when we say depleted, how can we distinguish this from, say, a usual stressful time? I mean, people go through stressful periods at work. Some people have stressful jobs. How can we distinguish this from everyday work stress?
So burnout, I would say, is something that you continue to feel day in and day out, and it's hard for you to shake. It's something where when that depletion begins to set in, it isn't just, oh, I had a bad day, I'm able to come home, relax, and begin anew. Burnout tends to stay with us, you know, for a little bit, to the point, for instance, where it might even be a couple of weeks where we just have a very hard time getting back in the game, right? Like whatever it is that we may have scheduled, we may not be making those appointments, or we might be missing, you know, assignments that we need to get in. It comes to a point where it begins to impact us both in our work, but then also interpersonally, you know, as well, perhaps with colleagues, supervisors, et cetera.
And so are there commonalities that people experience when they're feeling burnt out? You mentioned a couple physical symptoms, oftentimes maybe people having things like insomnia, for example, or fatigue. But is there, and I imagine this could probably manifest in a lot of different physical ways, right?
So the thing about it is, when you're speaking like from a clinical, you know, perspective, and you're tying those symptoms in, a lot of it is really determined by the amount of time something goes on. So for instance, you can feel fatigued, right, for one day, and you're able to shake it off and move on. But when it begins to persist over time, it then can be burnout, or can even turn into what's called like chronic fatigue syndrome. Now, something like that is lasting like at least 6 months. So you would still have those same types of indicators, right? But the time is what's different. And when it comes to what you're experiencing physically, you know, tension, feeling very just lethargic, not able to really move, you know, yourself the way that you are accustomed to. And also want to take into consideration that it's not just physical sometimes, it can even impact our ability to concentrate. So you might be, you know, moving pretty freely, right? But you aren't able to sit down and hone in the way that you're accustomed to doing. So it's important for us to make that distinguishment between what's happening with us physically, emotionally, and mentally.
I'm speaking with Samantha Coleman, a professor in industrial and organizational psychology at Adler University in Chicago. Professor Coleman, how does this differ from something like depression or stress or anxiety? Because I think a lot of those things that you just described might be common for someone who's going through depression or anxiety, too.
I think that's an excellent question. And I would say, like, the key differentiator between the two, right? So burnout and like a clinical diagnosis such as depression is really about the self. And what I mean by that is when an individual becomes depressed, you know, sometimes there is a loss of self-confidence, self-hatred, sometimes even contempt, and that is directed toward the individual. Whereas when it comes to burnout, I think it tends to step outside of the self. So if I am feeling, you know, angry, if you will, or I am frustrated because I am burned out, that anger is then directed towards the organization. It isn't looked at, you know, like I am the cause, you know, of the issue, you know, per se, because we're looking at, again, the relationship between the individual and their work and feeling overworked. And so when there's that struggle like that, you tend to look outward as opposed to looking inward the same way that you would with depression.
And so we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that the World Health Organization has just changed and clarified the definition of burnout. Why is it important to draw these distinctions? How does defining this help you study this and then, I imagine, also treat burnout?
Absolutely. So for myself, I don't treat clinically. What I do, however, as an executive coach, work with a ton of leaders, and burnout is right there at the top of what they're experiencing and why they have difficulty in really leading their organizations, right? Because what they're experiencing is that inability, if you will, to navigate all of the responsibilities that they have, those of their employees, et cetera, et cetera. And so when I'm working with them, they really have that opportunity to talk about feeling guilty or of not being able to perform in the way that they would, or that they don't feel supported when they need to slow down. And so when looking at the new definition by World Health Organization, energy depletion and exhaustion, mental distance from one's job, reduced professional productivity, these are all key pieces that come up, not just with leaders and organizations, of course, but across pretty much everyone, I would say, you know, has experiences at some point, myself included. And so what's important here is to just simply understand that we can't do it all, you know, within our workplaces, and that we really have to make that distinguishment between ourselves and our work and to really try and alleviate those symptoms that can come into play.
Professor Coleman, do you think this is a uniquely American problem? I think it's interesting that the World Health Organization is involved with this.
Now, that is a good question. I think that as human beings, right, like no matter where you are, that this can be an international, you know, concern as well. But I think it also has to do with Americans' abilities to, one, identify that, you know what, I'm burned out, you know, right now. And then am I consciously going to take the effort to engage in activities that are really going to promote my self-care? And so in doing so, again, alleviating that guilt and not feeling ashamed that you need to take a step back and reset. Whereas, you know, internationally, it might be like, you know, more opportunities to really like engage in like that meditative space, or, you know, there's deliberate.
Or have more vacation time. I was just thinking, like, just from a practical standpoint, right?
Absolutely. You know, those things, you know, are in place in, you know, other countries. But that does not mean that they don't experience the same thing. It means that there are things there, or there are interventions, if you will, put in place for when that occurs, because it would be unfair to say that, you know, it's just Americans that experience burnout. And also, too, we cannot step away from the fact that burnout is also not just something that occurs from the professional, you know, stance. It also occurs within our personal lives as well, if we don't take the opportunity to, you know, take a step back and evaluate what's happening and what is essentially taking from our energy.
And so we've been primarily talking about burnout from a work-life standpoint. And so I wanted to just end by asking you, you mentioned self-care. What other tips or ideas or advice you have for people once they've identified this, what they should do?
Absolutely. The first thing that to me is very crucial and what takes the most work is shifting your own mentality. And what I mean by that is essentially stepping away from the need to continuously prove oneself, you know, whether it's proving yourself to family members, friends, your boss, you know, the one person that you have to make happy in this world is yourself. Okay. So you really have to get into the mindset of not needing to prove yourself to other people all the time. I think another piece too is that we have to understand that no is an absolute complete sentence. Now, of course, when we are in the workspace, we have to say no in a respectful way and, of course, provide, you know, information as to why that no is legitimate. But in that, there is that concept of self-advocacy. It's necessary for us to have conversations without shame or guilt that we need some time, some space to, you know, re-energize. I think it's also important for us to be mindful of being present in the moment. And just to go a little bit further with that in terms of being present, I want to touch on work-life balance. So we continuously hear about balancing work and life. And part of where that guilt comes from, particularly when we begin to feel burnout, is that we feel imbalanced because we think that 50% should be going toward, you know, work and 50% should be going towards our professional. But in actuality, what we really want to strive for is harmony. So there is a concept called work-life harmony, and it suggests that no aspect of our life is going to get 50-50, right? On some days, work is going to get 80% and the home life is going to get 20% and vice versa. But when we are in each of those domains, we give it 100% and we're fully present there. But when we switch to the next thing, the other piece is no longer, you know, a part of what we're doing. So when we're at home, we're at home. When we're at work, we're at work. And so there's such a blurred line these days, particularly with technology coming into play, where there's difficulty in, you know, that work and leisure, you know, line. So, you know, I also suggest really taking technology breaks. It's very easy, particularly from the workspace, to, you know, jump on a LinkedIn, right? But you're still looking at stuff that's related to your work. Even with like social media, it's very important to take that time away from anything that isn't consistently feeding you, if you will.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
And then lastly, in terms of our energy management and prioritization, we really have to get in tune with what depletes us and what restores us. So if I know that, you know, engaging in, I don't know.
Well, social media maybe could deplete you rather than restoring you.
Correct. I am one of those people, like, going onto social media is not good for me at all, because it's a time sucker, you know, for me. And what does that do? It ends up putting me behind. And then I feel even more like, oh, now I got to get this done. Now I got to get that done. You know, it's one of those things where you really have to look at what actions am I taking that are ultimately not going to be for my best interest. So it's extremely crucial for us to prioritize, you know, throughout the day, being very strategic in really utilizing like you know, or understanding like where your most energy is at. So if you're a person that has top energy within the afternoon, well, then that's where you want to schedule your most brain intensive, you know, activities. Do it there. You know, everyone isn't a morning person. So you don't want to force yourself into, you know, trying to get work done in a specific space that just isn't going to, you know, work for you. And again, it's important for you to have those conversations with people, you know, whether it's your superiors, family, friends, and so on. I think the last thing that I would want to point out as well for any listeners who might be leaders within organizations, managers, is that it's going to be important to knowing that burnout is something that happens. It happens to the best of us. I personally don't know anyone that it hasn't, you know, happened to at some point in time. But there are some individuals that it happens to quite frequently. And so it's very important for leadership to assess the culture of the organization. If you begin to get feedback that your workers are feeling not just burned out, it can also come in the guise of the engagement is low, the satisfaction is low, the productivity and performance is low. So when you begin to look at those things and you ask that question of, well, why is that? Sometimes burnout is the culprit. And if this is what you come to find out, then begin to develop a strategic plan about how you are going to support, uplift, re-energize your workforce. You know, build in those flexible schedules, remote working options, and even just like on a personal level, ask me how I'm doing. You know, acknowledge the fact that it's a high stress environment. You know, sometimes it just is what it is, right? But acknowledge that, assess my feelings, and allow for me to vent. Even sometimes people just getting that off of their chest is the perfect way for them to restore, because now I feel that someone understands me, you know? And then the last thing that I want to say too, particularly for leaders, is don't heavily rely on your high performers, okay?
Because so, then you burn them out.
You absolutely. Absolutely. And what you want to do, look at it like this. There are multiple people that make up your workforce, tons of unique skills, talents, diverse perspectives. So don't always rely on the one person. Instead, grow yourself as a leader by coaching and developing someone else to get to the next level as well. And this is like a key way to also minimize the burnout of your high performers.
That's Professor Samantha Coleman. She teaches industrial and organizational psychology at Adler University in Chicago. As she's saying, she also works with lots of executives on this issue of burnout. Professor Coleman, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Back in June, residents near Cleveland had a shaky start to the day when a 4.2 magnitude earthquake rattled northeast Ohio. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, an earthquake of that magnitude is noticeable but doesn't cause much damage at all. It's a good reminder, though, that earthquakes do happen in the Midwest. In fact, geologists say large damaging earthquakes have occurred in the Midwest in the past and are expected again. In 1811 and 1812, there were a series of earthquakes in the middle of the country known as the New Madrid earthquakes, some of the largest in American history. They were so strong that for a short time, they changed the direction the Mississippi River flowed. Canaveri Valencius is a history professor at Boston College who wrote a book about the New Madrid quakes. Tim Larson is a senior geophysicist with the Illinois State Geological Survey. They both spoke with Nyla Boodoo about this earlier in the summer.
So, Conover, when we think of earthquakes, I think everyone does tend to think of the West Coast, right? And I mean, we think of California, or we think of maybe earthquakes that happen in Asia or South America. In your book, you write about the New Madrid quakes. Can you remind us where these quakes happened?
So, you know, as if tornadoes and floods weren't enough, right? The Midwest also has to deal with earthquakes. These took place around the what we now call the Missouri Boot Heel. and they were epicentered there, but affected a really large swath of the country. And for reasons that geologists like Tim know way better than I do, earthquake movement travels a lot better in the mid-continent than it does out on the West Coast. So people actually felt the shocks of the New Madrid quakes, even though they were right along the middle Mississippi River. They felt them way out east and way up north of where they were, of where the epicenters were.
And can you paint a picture for us what these earthquakes were like in terms of how much damage they caused and those sorts of things?
So in modern terms, you know, we might look at the magnitude, and there's a lot of debate about the magnitude, but most people with expert opinions think they're, you know, in the low sevens, like maybe 7.3 to 7.5 moment magnitude. And in a lot of parts of the world, that would be a respectable quake, even a large quake, but not a devastating one. But these were happening in areas of really fertile floodplain, as y'all's reader, you know, as your listeners would know, really soft, what scientists call unconsolidated soil. And it would shake, and in fact, it would shake in the really disturbing term that kept coming up when I was interviewing scientists was like a bowl full of jelly. So what would happen and was really cataclysmic for the people who felt them. Huge fissures opened in the earth called earthquake cracks. Large forests were actually snapped off mid-trunk. Really big trees got snapped over. The huge sand blows boiled up, and these were these things that kind of looked like small volcanoes. I mean, they weren't volcanoes in our...
Did you say sand blows?
Yeah. So these were like, you know, water under the surface put under great pressure, and it would spout up, making enormous piles of hot, wet sand.
Wow. How did you find out?
You can imagine.
And where did you get the details for this in your book? Because there are so many details of everything that happened.
So what's fascinating to me was that I grew up near that area in Arkansas, not far from where y'all's listeners are, and I didn't know anything about this. And I first started reading this as a historian of the 19th century in actually an account by Davy Crockett. And I thought, this guy knows what's going on. Why is he making up tall tales about earthquakes? So I started reading about them, and they were all over the popular press of the early 19th century. These were a big deal, and they got widely reported, but then they got subsequently completely erased from our histories and from our scientific knowledge for a very long time.
That's Canavery Valentius, the author of The Lost History of the New Madrid Quakes. Tim Larson is in studio with me as well here in Urbana. He's a geophysicist. And Tim, so when we think about the New Madrid Fault that caused this, so this quake was more than 200 years ago, right? This was the winter of 1811, 1812. Is this still active? This is still an active fault line.
It is still active today. There is very small earthquakes, magnitude 2, 2.5, barely felt at all.
So feel that?
Those happen every day. There's very good instrumentation down in that area today, and there's daily earthquakes in the New Madrid Fault Zone. They're not hardly felt at all. As you come further north into Illinois, there's another fault zone we call the Wabash Valley Fault Zone. Some people say it's an extension of the New Madrid. We would say it's something different. And we have earthquakes there every several a year that are felt. We have magnitude 5 earthquakes there about every 20 years.
Okay.
Some people might even remember that one back in 2008 was the last time we had a magnitude 5.2 earthquake.
And that was felt as how far north was that felt?
It woke me up here in Urbana.
Okay.
And it was felt up in Chicago as well.
It was. Mm-hmm. So, Raymond, can you give us just a quick geography lesson here of where this fault line is and where people should be most concerned when we think about where the epicenter might be or epicenters could be?
Well, the New Madrid Zone goes up to the very southern end of Illinois. Then there's a break, and then on the northeast, on the southeast part of Illinois, there's the Wabash River. In the Wabash River Valley, there's faults that go through there, and they have been, seem to be reactivated recently, and they have magnitude 5 earthquakes. There was one in 68, one in the 80s, 2008. There might have been some, even a long time ago, we have evidence of those sand blows, even in the Wabash Valley Zone from a long time ago. So that's what we have here in Illinois. There's actually more larger earthquakes in Illinois than there are in the New Madrid Zone today. Now, we do know that those New Madrid earthquakes happen every 500 to 1,000 years. So we still know there's large earthquakes that happen down there. But it's a very difficult thing for us in the science because the small ones, the little tiny ones that happen down there, but the bigger medium-sized ones are not.
Do we know why they happen every 500 to 1,000 years?
Now, there's another good question. Why are we having these big earthquakes in the middle of the continent? We know more about the mechanics of earthquakes around the edges of the continents, around the ring of fire, as you talked about, that goes all the way around, say, the Pacific coast. But why do we have them in the middle? And that is a very difficult question to understand because there's so few of them, it's hard to see where they are occurring. They seem to happen on areas that were once the edge of the continent and are now being reactivated depending upon the stresses of modern, as the plates move across those areas today.
That's Tim Larson, who's a geophysicist with the Illinois State Geological Survey. We're also speaking with Canavari Valencius, a history professor at Boston College and author of The Lost History of the New Madrid Quakes. And when we think about that, Canavari, I wonder if we know if when those earthquakes happened, so this is 1811, 1812, did people have a sense that, was there any level of expectation that this was an earthquake zone? Were people prepared? Did they think this would happen?
A lot of people who felt it thought it was the end of the world. You know, a lot of the Americans and Europeans in the area saw flashing lights in the sky. They smelt sulfur from all the marsh gas coming up. The earth shook and hot water came from underground. And they were pretty clear on what was going on. They read their Bible. It took a while for these events to actually even be classed as an earthquake, for people to understand, like, oh, that's what made me feel sick at my stomach and made my cattle all run away, you know, and made this new swampland appear. That was actually what we would call an earthquake. And one of the real interesting things to see in the discussions of the New Madrid quakes is how early American science took place as a lot of different people discussed what had happened, how they could try to measure it or understand the extent of it. You know, where was it centered? Who felt it? What did it do? And so looking at the earthquakes is a way to understand both people, how people understood things spiritually and then how they came to terms with them scientifically.
And then so how did these tales, I mean, these tales, like these became like, as you mentioned Davy Crockett, like did these things sort of be, these actual events become like tales and people didn't think they really happened?
Yes, and I think it's really a cautionary story for us today because these events were widely recognized as having happened and everybody understood about them in the early 19th century and didn't know why they'd happened, but know they'd taken place. And then because of these earthquakes, as well as, you know, a bunch of other stuff that's happening in the early 19th century, the folks who'd felt the quakes closest to the epicenters moved away, and a flood of other immigration really put in a new populations in the areas closest to the epicenters down in the southern part of Illinois and in what's now Missouri. Those folks didn't have a memory of these quakes as clearly. Then they also put in place a lot of other environmental uses of the land, like timbering and lumbering and creating a lot of swamp drainage and cotton cultivation that erased a lot of the original environmental evidence of the quakes. And then some really exciting science happened. Scientists in the 1880s were able to, for the first time, realize their dream of getting self-registering instruments, getting machines that would record and quantify what earthquakes were doing. And that was tremendously exciting and gave us a lot of our modern earthquake science today. It really gave birth to modern seismology. But that instrumental revolution of modern seismology also meant that accounts and stories that had been taken place in, published in newspapers with lots of exclamation points and lots of commentaries about how much the dogs barked, well, that wasn't real science anymore. You know, that became seen as part of a folk record, not real modern stuff. So in a way, the creation of our modern seismology gave us a whole lot of knowledge, but made some of the prior information seem much less valuable. at least for a while, until modern scientists have rediscovered that record.
So, Tim, you're nodding, and as the modern scientist in the room, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more. When we were looking at USGS maps, there is still a region of southern Illinois that's kind of bright pink and fuchsia. Does that tell us what our earthquake risk might be for that part of the state of Illinois?
The USGS seismic hazard maps in the eastern part of the U.S. are based more on where there's been earthquakes that
on
we
history.
Know of.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the historical earthquakes and the what we would call the instrumental earthquakes, as opposed to out west where you can see faults that's mapped based on the faults. You can't hardly see the faults around here anyway. Those are based on the effects that have been known from the past earthquakes. So the bright red that you see down there along the Boot Hill is from the New Madrid earthquakes.
And do you think we're prepared?
Now, that's a loaded question, Hila. Are we prepared?
Let me put it this way. Are we aware of it? Do you think people are aware of the possibility, which in my mind would be a big part of preparation, right?
Yes, I think people in the southern part of our state are much more prepared than they are further north. And we still have that same issue that we've been talking about of a transiency of people. 2008, it was an earthquake that woke me up. And I talked to people around here. Do you remember that? No, I don't. I wasn't here in 2008. Well, that's just barely 10, 11 years ago.
Right.
We still have that transiency. So we're still having the problem of people's memory. And that's what's most important, people remembering it.
Hmm. And so if you want to remember a little bit more or learn a little bit more of the history, Canaveri Valencia's book is called The Lost History of the New Madrid Quakes. I want to thank her. She teaches history at Boston College for joining us from Boston. Tim Larson is a geophysicist with Illinois State Geological Survey. We have a lot more information about this. USGS has actually published a lot of things to the point of preparedness that we will tweet out and have links at our website. But guys, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Starting tomorrow, Lee Gaines will be in the host chair for the rest of the week. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment about what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. All those links and every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got our past shows there as well. You can also find us in most places you get your podcast. We're on Spotify now, as well as Apple Podcasts and NPR One. Search for The 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montecelio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpazon is our intern. Technical direction and engineering come from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.